Chapter 12. Tommy meets an old friend. From the opposite side of the road, Tommy surveyed the premises of Messrs. Partingdale, Harris, Lockeridge and Partingdale. They looked eminently respectable and old-fashioned. The brass plate was well-worn but nicely polished. He crossed the street and passed through swing doors to be greeted by the muted note of typewriters at full speed. He addressed himself to an open mahogany window on his right, which bore the legend Inquiries. Inside was a small room where three women were typing, and two male clerks were bending over desks, copying documents. There was a faintly musty atmosphere, with a decidedly legal flavour. A woman of 35-odd, with a severe air, faded blonde hair, and pince-nez, rose from her typewriter and came to the window. "Can I help you? I would like to see Mr. Eccles." The woman's air of severity redoubled. "Have you an appointment?" "I'm afraid not. I'm just passing through London today." "I'm afraid Mr. Eccles is rather busy this morning. Perhaps another member of the firm—" "It was Mr. Eccles I particularly wanted to see. I've already had some correspondence with him." "Oh, I see. Perhaps you'll give me your name?" Tommy gave his name and address, and the blonde woman retired to confer with the telephone on her desk. After a murmured conversation, she returned. "The clerk will show you into the waiting room. Mr. Eccles will be able to see you in about 10 minutes' time." Tommy was ushered into a waiting room, which had a bookcase of rather ancient and ponderous-looking law tomes, and a round table covered with various financial papers. Tommy sat there and went over in his own mind his planned methods of approach. He wondered what Mr. Eccles would be like. When he was shown in at last, and Mr. Eccles rose from a desk to receive him, he decided, for no particular reason that he could name to himself, that he did not like Mr. Eccles. He also wondered why he did not like Mr. Eccles. There seemed no valid reason for dislike. Mr. Eccles was a man between 40 and 50, with greyish hair thinning a little at the temples. He had a long, rather sad-looking face, with a particularly wooden expression, shrewd eyes, and quite a pleasant smile, which from time to time rather unexpectedly broke up the natural melancholy of his countenance.
"Mr. Beresford?"
"Yes. It is really rather a trifling matter, but my wife has been worried about it. She wrote to you, I believe, or possibly she may have rung you up, to know if you could give her the address of a Mrs. Lancaster."
"Mrs. Lancaster," said Mr. Eccles, retaining a perfect poker face. It was not even a question. He just left the name hanging in the air. "A cautious man," thought Tommy. "But then it's second nature for lawyers to be cautious. In fact, if they were one's own lawyers, one would prefer them to be cautious." He went on. "Until lately, living at a place called Sunny Ridge, an establishment and a very good one for elderly ladies. In fact, an aunt of my own was there and was extremely happy and comfortable." "Oh, yes, of course, I remember now. Mrs. Lancaster, yes. She is, I think, no longer living there. That is right, is it not?"
"Yes," said Tommy.
"At the moment I do not exactly recall—" He stretched out a hand towards the telephone. "I will just refresh my memory."
"I can tell you quite simply," said Tommy. "My wife wanted Mrs. Lancaster's address because she happens to be in possession of a piece of property which originally belonged to Mrs. Lancaster. A picture, in fact. It was given by Mrs. Lancaster as a present to my aunt, Miss Fanshawe. My aunt died recently, and her few possessions have come into our keeping. This included the picture which was given her by Mrs. Lancaster. My wife likes it very much, but she feels rather guilty about it. She thinks that it may be a picture Mrs. Lancaster values, and in that case she feels she ought to offer to return it to Mrs. Lancaster."
"Ah, I see," said Mr. Eccles. "It is very conscientious of your wife, I'm sure."
"Oh, one never knows," said Tommy, smiling pleasantly, "what elderly people may feel about their possessions. She may have been glad for my aunt to have it, since my aunt admired it, but as my aunt died very soon after having received this gift, it seems perhaps a little unfair that it should pass into the possession of strangers. There is no particular title on the picture. It represents a house somewhere in the country. For all I know, it may be some family house associated with Mrs. Lancaster."
"Quite, quite," said Mr. Eccles. "But I don't think—" There was a knock, and the door opened, and a clerk entered and produced a sheet of paper, which he placed before Mr. Eccles. Mr. Eccles looked down. Ah, yes, I remember now. Yes, I believe Mrs. He glanced down at Tommy's card lying on his desk. Beresford rang up and had a few words with me. I advised her to get into touch with the Southern Counties Bank, Hammersmith branch. This is the only address I myself know. Letters addressed to the bank's address, care of Mrs. Richard Johnson, would be forwarded. Mrs. Johnson is, I believe, a niece or distant cousin of Mrs. Lancaster's, and it was Mrs. Johnson who made all the arrangements with me for Mrs. Lancaster's reception at Sunny Ridge. She asked me to make full inquiries about the establishment, since she had only heard about it casually from a friend. We did so, I can assure you, most carefully. It was said to be an excellent establishment, and I believe Mrs. Johnson's relative, Mrs. Lancaster, spent several years there quite happily. As she left there, though rather suddenly, Tommy suggested. Yes, yes, I believe she did. Mrs. Johnson, it seems, returned rather unexpectedly recently from East Africa. So many people have done so. She and her husband had, I believe, resided in Kenya for many years. They were making various new arrangements and felt able to assume personal care of their elderly relative. I'm afraid I have no knowledge of Mrs. Johnson's present whereabouts. I had a letter from her thanking me and settling accounts she owed, and directing that if there was any necessity for communicating with her, I should address my letters care of the bank, as she was undecided, as yet, where she and her husband would actually be residing. I'm afraid, Mr. Beresford, that that is all I know. His manner was gentle but firm. It displayed no embarrassment of any kind nor disturbance, but the finality of his tone was very definite. Then he unbent, and his manner softened a little. I shouldn't really worry, you know, Mr. Beresford, he said reassuringly. Or rather, I shouldn't let your wife worry. Mrs. Lancaster, I believe, is quite an old lady and inclined to be forgetful. She's probably forgotten all about this picture that she gave away. She is, I believe, 75 or 76 years of age. One forgets very easily at that age, you know. And did you know her personally? No, I never actually met her. But you knew Mrs. Johnson. I met her when she came here occasionally to consult me as to arrangements. She seemed a pleasant, business-like woman, quite competent in the arrangements she was making. He rose and said, I am so sorry I can't help you, Mr. Beresford. It was a gentle but firm dismissal. Tommy came out onto the Bloomsbury Street and looked about him for a taxi. The parcel he was carrying, though not heavy, was of a fairly awkward size. He looked up for a moment at the building he had just left. Eminently respectable. Long established. Nothing you could fault there. Nothing apparently wrong with Messrs. Partingdale, Harris, Lockeridge, and Partingdale. Nothing wrong with Mr. Eccles. No signs of alarm or despondency. No shiftiness or uneasiness. In books, Tommy thought gloomily, a mention of Mrs. Lancaster or Mrs. Johnson should have brought a guilty start, or a shifty glance, something to show that the names registered that all was not well. Things didn't seem to happen like that in real life. All Mr. Eccles had looked like was a man who was too polite to resent having his time wasted by such an inquiry as Tommy had just made. But all the same, thought Tommy to himself, I don't like Mr. Eccles. He recalled to himself vague memories of the past, of other people that he had for some reason not liked. Very often, those hunches, for hunches as all they were, had been right. But perhaps it was simpler than that. If you had had a good many dealings in your time with personalities, you had a sort of feeling about them, just as an expert antique dealer knows instinctively the taste and look and feel of a forgery before getting down to expert tests and examinations. The thing is just wrong. The same with pictures. The same, presumably, with a cashier in a bank who is offered a first-class, spurious banknote. He sounds all right, thought Tommy. He looks all right. He speaks all right, but all the same. He waved frantically at a taxi, which gave him a direct and cold look, increased its speed, and drove on. Swine, thought Tommy. His eyes roved up and down the street, seeking for a more obliging vehicle. A fair amount of people were walking on the pavement, a few hurrying, some strolling, one man gazing at a brass plate just across the road from him. After a close scrutiny, he turned round, and Tommy's eyes opened a little wider. He knew that face. He watched the man walk to the end of the street, pause and turn back again. Somebody came out of the building behind Tommy, and at that moment the man opposite increased his pace a little, still walking on the other side of the road, but keeping pace with the man who had come out of the door. The man who had come out of Messrs. Partingdale, Harris, Lockeridge, and Partingdale's doorway was, Tommy thought, looking after this retreating figure. Almost certainly Mr. Eccles. At the same moment, a taxi lingering in a pleasant, tempting manner came along. Tommy raised his hand. The taxi drew up. He opened the door and got in.
Where to?
Tommy hesitated for a moment, looking at his parcel. About to give an address, he changed his mind and said, 14 Lyon Street. A quarter of an hour later, he had reached his destination. He rang the bell after paying off the taxi and asked for Mr. Ivor Smith. When he entered a second-floor room, a man sitting at a table facing the window swung round and said with faint surprise, "Hello, Tommy. Fancy seeing you. It's a long time. What are you doing here? Just tooling round, looking up your old friends?" "Not quite as good as that, Ivor. I suppose you're on your way home after a conference." "Yes." "All a lot of the usual talky-talky, I suppose? No conclusions drawn, nothing helpful said?" "Quite right. All a sheer waste of time. Mostly listening to old Bogey Waddock shooting his mouth off, I expect. Crashing bore gets worse every year." "Oh, well." Tommy sat down in the chair that was pushed towards him, accepted a cigarette and said, "I just wondered, it's a very long shot, whether you know anything of a derogatory nature about one Eccles, a solicitor of the firm of Messrs. Partingdale, Harris, Lockeridge and Partingdale." "Well, well, well," said the man called Ivor Smith. He raised his eyebrows. They were very convenient eyebrows for raising. The end of them, near the nose, went up, and the opposite end, near the cheek, went down, to an almost astonishing extent. They made him, on very little provocation, look like a man who had had a severe shock. But actually it was quite a common gesture with him. "Run up against Eccles somewhere, have you?" "But the trouble is," said Tommy, "that I know nothing about him." "And you want to know something about him?" "Yes." "Hmm. What made you come and see me?" "I saw Anderson outside. It was a long time since I'd seen him, but I recognized him. He was keeping someone or other under observation. Whoever it was someone from the building from which I had just emerged. Two firms of lawyers practice there, and one firm of chartered accountants. Of course, it may be any one of them, or any member of any one of them, but a man walking away down the street looked to me like Eccles, and I just wondered if, by a lucky chance, it could have been my Mr. Eccles that Anderson was giving his attention to." "Hmm," said Ivor Smith. "Well, Tommy, you always were a pretty good guesser." "Who is Eccles?" "Well, don't you know? Haven't you any idea?" "I've no idea whatever," said Tommy. "Without going into a long history, I went to him for some information about an old lady who has recently left an old lady's home. The solicitor employed to make arrangements for her was Mr. Eccles. He appears to have done it with perfect decorum and efficiency. I wanted her present address. He says he hasn't got it. Quite possibly he hasn't, but I wondered. He's the only clue to her whereabouts I've got." "And you want to find her?" "Yes." "I don't think it sounds as though I'm going to be much good to you. Eccles is a very respectable, sound solicitor who makes a large income, has a good many highly respectable clients, works for the landed gentry, professional classes and retired soldiers and sailors, generals and admirals, all that sort of thing. He's the acme of respectability. I should imagine from what you're talking about that he was strictly within his lawful activities." "But you're interested in him," suggested Tommy. "Yes, we're very interested in Mr. James Eccles," he sighed. "We've been interested in him for at least 6 years. We haven't progressed very far." "Very interesting," said Tommy. "I'll ask you again. Who exactly is Mr. Eccles?" "You mean, what do we suspect Eccles of? Well, to put it in a sentence, We suspect him of being one of the best organizing brains in criminal activity in this country.
Criminal activity?
Tommy looked surprised. Oh, yes, yes. No cloak and dagger, no espionage, no counter-espionage, no plain criminal activity. He is a man who has, so far as we can discover, never performed a criminal act in his life. He has never stolen anything, he's never forged anything, he's never converted funds. We can't get any kind of evidence against him, but all the same, whenever there's a big planned organized robbery, there we find, somewhere in the background, Mr. Eccles, leading a blameless life.
6 years, said Tommy thoughtfully.
Possibly even longer than that. It took a little time to get onto the pattern of things. Bank hold-ups, robberies, private jewels, all sorts of things where the big money was. They're all jobs that followed a certain pattern. You couldn't help feeling that the same mind had planned them. The people who directed them and who carried them out never had to do any planning at all. They went where they were told. They did what they were ordered. They never had to think. Somebody else was doing all the thinking.
And what made you hit on Eccles?
Ivor Smith shook his head thoughtfully.
It would take too long to tell you. He's a man who has a lot of acquaintances, a lot of friends. There are people he plays golf with. There are people who service his car. There are firms of stockbrokers who act for him. There are companies doing a blameless business in which he is interested.
The plan is getting clearer, but his part in it hasn't got much clearer. Except that he is very conspicuously absent on certain occasions. A big bank robbery, cleverly planned and no expense spared, mind you. Consolidating the getaway and all the rest of it. And where's Mr. Eccles when it happens?
Monte Carlo.
Or Zurich. Or possibly even fishing for salmon in Norway. You can be quite sure Mr. Eccles is never within 100 miles of where criminal activities are happening.
Yet you suspect him.
Oh, yes. I'm quite sure in my own mind, but whether we'll ever catch him, I don't know. The man who tunneled through the floor of a bank, the man who knocked out the night watchman, the cashier who was in it from the beginning, the bank manager who supplied the information, none of them know Eccles. Probably they've never even seen him. There's a long chain leading away, and no one seems to know more than just one link beyond themselves.
The good old plan of the cell.
More or less, yes. But there's some original thinking. Someday we'll get a chance. Somebody who oughtn't to know anything will know something. Something silly and trivial, perhaps, but something that, strangely enough, may be evidence at last.
Is he married? Got a family?
No. He has never taken risks like that. He lives alone with a housekeeper and a gardener and a butler valet. He entertains in a mild and pleasant way, and I dare swear that every single person who's entered his house as his guest is beyond suspicion.
And nobody's getting rich.
That's a good point you put your finger on. Somebody ought to be getting rich. Somebody ought to be seen to be getting rich, but that part of it's very cleverly arranged. Big wins on racecourses, investments in stocks and shares, all things which are natural, just chancy enough to make big money at, and all apparently genuine transactions. There's a lot of money stacked up abroad in different countries and different places. It's a great, big, vast money-making concern, and the money's always on the move, going from place to place.
Well, said Tommy, good luck to you. I hope you get your man.
I think I shall, you know, someday. There might be a hope if one could jolt him out of his routine.
Or jolt him with what?
Danger, said Ivor. Make him feel he's in danger. Make him feel someone's onto him. Get him uneasy. If you once get a man uneasy, he may do something foolish. He may make a mistake. That's the way you get chaps, you know. Take the cleverest man there is, who can plan brilliantly and never put a foot wrong. Let some little thing rattle him, and he'll make a mistake. So I'm hoping. Now let's hear your story. You might know something that would be useful.
Or nothing to do with crime, I'm afraid. Very small beer.
Well, let's hear about it.
Tommy told his story without undue apologies for the triviality of it.
Ivor, he knew, was not a man to despise triviality. Ivor, indeed, went straight to the point which had brought Tommy on his errand.
And your wife's disappeared, you say?
It's not like her. That's serious. Serious to me, all right.
So I can imagine. I only met your missus once. She's sharp. If she goes after things, she's like a terrier on a trail, said Thomas.
You've not been to the police?
No.
Why not?
Well, first, because I can't believe that she's anything but all right. Tuppence is always all right. She just goes all out after any hare that shows itself. She mayn't have had time to communicate.
I don't like it very much.
She's looking for a house, you say?
That just might be interesting, because among various odds and ends that we've followed, which incidentally have not led to much, are a kind of trail of house agents.
House agents?
Tommy looked surprised.
Yes, nice, ordinary, rather mediocre house agents in small provincial towns in different parts of England, but none of them so very far from London. Mr. Eccles's firm does a lot of business with and for house agents. Sometimes he's the solicitor for the buyers, and sometimes for the sellers, and he employs various house agencies on behalf of clients. Sometimes we rather wondered why. None of it seems very profitable, you see.
But you think it might mean something, or lead to something?
Well, if you remember the big London Southern Bank robbery some years ago, there was a house in the country, a lonely house, that was the thieves' rendezvous. They weren't very noticeable there, but that's where the stuff was brought and cashed away. People in the neighbourhood began to have a few stories about them, and wonder who these people were who came and went at rather unusual hours. Different kinds of cars arriving in the middle of the night and going away again. People are curious about their neighbours in the country. Sure enough, the police raided the place. They got some of the loot, and they got three men, including one, who was recognised and identified.
Well, didn't that lead you somewhere?
Not really. The men wouldn't talk. They were well defended and represented. They got long sentences in jail, and within a year and a half, they were all out of the jug again. Very clever rescues.
I seem to remember reading about it.
One man disappeared from a criminal court where he was brought up by two warders.
That's right.
All very cleverly arranged, and an enormous amount of money spent on the escape. But we think whoever was responsible for the staff work realized he made a mistake in having one house for too long a time, so that the local people got interested. Somebody perhaps thought it would be a better idea to get subsidiaries living in, say, as many as 30 houses in different places. People come and take a house, mother and daughter, say, a widow or a retired army man and his wife, nice quiet people. They have a few repairs done to the house, get a local builder in and improve the plumbing, and perhaps some other firm down from London to decorate. Then after a year, or a year and a half, circumstances arise, and the occupiers sell the house and go off abroad to live. Something like that. All very natural and pleasant. During their tenancy, that house has been used, perhaps for rather unusual purposes. But no one suspects such a thing. Friends come to see them. Not very often, just occasionally. One night, perhaps, a kind of anniversary party for a middle-aged or elderly couple, or a coming-of-age party. A lot of cars coming and going. Say there are five major robberies done within 6 months, but each time the loot passes through or is cashed in, not just one of these houses, but five different houses, in five different parts of the country. It's only a supposition as yet, my dear Tommy, but we're working on it. Let's say your old lady lets a picture of a certain house go out of her possession. And supposing that's a significant house. And supposing that that's the house that your missus has recognised somewhere and has gone dashing off to investigate. And supposing someone doesn't want that particular house investigated?
It might tie up, you know.
It's very far-fetched.
Oh yes, I agree.
But these times we live in are far-fetched times. In our particular world, incredible things happen.
Somewhat wearily, Tommy alighted from his fourth taxi of the day and looked appraisingly at his surroundings. The taxi had deposited him in a small cul-de-sac, which tucked itself coyly under one of the protuberances of Hampstead Heath. The cul-de-sac seemed to have been some artistic development. Each house was wildly different from the house next to it. This particular one seemed to consist of a large studio with skylights in it, and attached to it, rather like a gumboil, on one side, was what seemed to be a little cluster of three rooms. A ladder staircase, painted bright green, ran up the outside of the house. Tommy opened the small gate, went up a path, and not seeing a bell, applied himself to the knocker. Getting no response, he paused for a few moments, and then started again with the knocker, a little louder this time. The door opened so suddenly that he nearly fell backwards. A woman stood on the doorstep. At first sight, Tommy's first impression was that this was one of the plainest women he had ever seen. She had a large expanse of flat, pancake-like face, two enormous eyes which seemed of impossibly different colours, one green and one brown, a noble forehead with a quantity of wild hair rising up from it in a kind of thicket. She wore a purple overall with blotches of clay on it, and Tommy noticed that the hand that held the door open was one of exceeding beauty of structure. "Oh," she said. Her voice was deep and rather attractive. "What is it? I'm busy." "Mrs. Boscawen?"
"Yes, what do you want?"
"My name's Beresford. I wondered if I might speak to you for a few moments."
"Oh, I don't know. Really, must you? What is it, something about a picture?"
Her eye had gone to what he held under his arm. "Yes, it's something to do with one of your husband's pictures."
"Do you want to sell it?"
"I've got plenty of his pictures. I don't want to buy any more of them. Take it to one of those galleries or something. They're beginning to buy him now." "You don't look as though you needed to sell pictures." "Oh, no, I don't want to sell anything." Tommy felt extraordinary difficulty in talking to this particular woman. Her eyes, unmatching though they were very fine eyes, and they were now looking over his shoulder down the street with an air of some peculiar interest at something in the far distance. "Oh, please," said Tommy. "I wish you'd let me come in. It's so difficult to explain."
"If you're a painter, I don't want to talk to you," said Mrs. Boscawen. "I find painters very boring, always."
"I'm not a painter."
"Well, you don't look like one, certainly."
Her eyes raked him up and down.
"You look more like a civil servant," she said disapprovingly.
"Can I come in, Mrs. Boscawen?"
"I'm not sure. Wait."
She shut the door rather abruptly. Tommy waited. After about 4 minutes had passed, the door opened again.
"All right," she said. "You can come in."
She led him through the doorway, up a narrow staircase, and into the large studio. In a corner of it there was a figure and various implements standing by it, hammers and chisels. There was also a clay head. The whole place looked as though it had recently been savaged by a gang of hooligans.
"There's never any room to sit up here," said Mrs. Boscawen.
She threw various things off a wooden stool and pushed it towards him.
"There. Sit down here and speak to me."
"It's very kind of you to let me come in."
"It is rather. But you looked so worried."
"You are worried, aren't you, about something?" "Yes, I am."
"I thought so. What are you worried about?"
"My wife," said Tommy, surprising himself by his answer.
"Oh, worried about your wife? Well, there's nothing unusual in that. Men are always worrying about their wives. What's the matter? Has she gone off with someone, or playing up?"
"No, no, nothing like that."
"Dying? Cancer?"
"No," said Tommy. "It's just that I don't know where she is."
"And you think I might?"
"Well, you better tell me her name and something about her if you think I can find her for you."
"I'm not sure, mind you," said Mrs. Boscawen, "that I shall want to. I'm warning you."
"Thank God," said Tommy. "You're more easy to talk to than I thought you were going to be."
"What's the picture got to do with it?"
"It is a picture, isn't it? Must be, that shape." Tommy undid the wrappings. "It's a picture signed by your husband," said Tommy. "I want you to tell me what you can about it."
"I see. What exactly do you want to know?"
"When it was painted, and where it is." Mrs. Boscawen looked at him for the first time. There was a slight look of interest in her eyes.
"Well, that's not difficult," she said. "Yes, I can tell you all about it. It was painted about 15 years ago. No, a good deal longer than that, I should think. It's one of his fairly early ones. 20 years ago, I should say."
"Do you know where it is? The place, I mean."
"Oh, yes, I can remember quite well. Nice picture. I always liked it. That's the little humpback bridge, and the house. And the name of the place is Sutton Chancellor, about 7 or 8 miles from Market Basing. The house itself is a couple of miles from Sutton Chancellor. Pretty place. Secluded."
She came up to the picture, bent down, and peered at it closely.
"Well, that's funny," she said. "Yes, that's very odd. I wonder now."
Tommy did not pay much attention. "What's the name of the house?" he asked.
"I can't really remember. It got renamed, you know, several times. I don't know what there was about it. A couple of rather tragic things happened there, I think. Then the next people who came along renamed it. Called the Canal House once, or Canal Side. Once it was called Bridge House. Then Meadowside or Riverside was another name.
Who lived there? Or who lives there now, do you know?
Nobody I know. A man and a girl lived there when I first saw it. Used to come down for weekends, not married, I think. The girl was a dancer, may have been an actress. No, I think she was a dancer, ballet dancer. Rather beautiful, but dumb. Simple, almost wanting. William was quite soft about her, I remember.
Did he paint her?
No, he didn't often paint people. He used to say sometimes he wanted to do a sketch of them, but he never did much about it. He was always silly over girls.
They were the people who were there when your husband was painting the house?
Yes, I think so. Part of the time, anyway. They only came down at weekends. Then there was some kind of a bust-up. They had a row, I think.
Or he went away and left her, or she went away and left him.
I wasn't down there myself. I was working in Coventry then, doing a group. After that, I think there was just a governess in the house and the child. I don't know who the child was or where she came from, but I suppose the governess was looking after her. Then I think something happened to the child. Either the governess took her away somewhere, or perhaps she died. What do you want to know about the people who lived in the house 20 years ago? Seems to me idiotic.
I want to hear anything I can about that house, said Tommy. You see, my wife went away to look for that house. She said she'd seen it out of a train somewhere.
Quite right, said Mrs. Boscawen. The railway line runs just the other side of the bridge. You can see the house very well from it, I expect.
Then she said,
why did you want to find that house?
Tommy gave her a much abridged explanation. She looked at him doubtfully.
You haven't come out of a mental home or anything, have you? Said Mrs. Muscowan. On parole or something, whatever they call it.
I suppose I must sound a little like that, said Tommy. But it's quite simple, really. My wife wanted to find out about this house, and so she tried to take various train journeys to find out where it was she'd seen it. Well, I think she did find out. I think she went there to this place, something Chancellor?
Sutton Chancellor, yes.
Very one-horse place it used to be. Of course, it may be a big development, or even one of those new dormitory towns by now. It might be anything, I expect, said Tommy. She telephoned she was coming back, but she didn't come back. And I want to know what's happened to her. I think she went and started investigating that house, and perhaps, well, perhaps she ran into danger.
What's dangerous about it?
I don't know, said Tommy. Neither of us knew. I didn't even think there could be any danger about it. But my wife did.
ESP?
Possibly. She's a little like that. She has hunches. You never heard or knew of a Mrs. Lancaster 20 years ago, or any time up to a month ago?
Mrs. Lancaster? No, I don't think so.
Sort of name one might remember, mightn't it be?
No, what about Mrs. Lancaster?
She was the woman who owned this picture. She gave it as a friendly gesture to an aunt of mine, then she left an old people's home rather suddenly. Her relatives took her away. I tried to trace her, but it isn't easy.
Who's the one who's got the imagination, you or your wife?
You seem to have thought up a lot of things, and to be rather in a state, if I may say so.
Oh, yes, you can say so, said Tommy.
Rather in a state, and all about nothing at all, that's what you mean, isn't it? I suppose you're right, too.
No,
said Mrs. Boscawen. Her voice had altered slightly. I wouldn't say about nothing at all. Tommy looked at her inquiringly.
There's one thing that's odd about that picture, said Mrs. Boscawen. Very odd.
I remember it quite well, you know. I remember most of William's pictures, although he painted such a lot of them. Do you remember who it was sold to, if it was sold?
No, I don't remember that.
Yes, I think it was sold. There was a whole batch of his paintings sold from one of his exhibitions. They ran back for about 3 or 4 years before this, and a couple of years later than this. Quite a lot of them were sold, nearly all of them. But I can't remember, by now, who it was sold to. That's asking too much. I'm very grateful for all you have remembered.
You haven't asked me yet why I said there was something odd about the picture. This picture that you brought here.
Oh, you mean it's not your husband's? Somebody else painted it?
Oh, no, that's the picture that William painted. House by a Canal, I think he called it, in the catalogue.
But it isn't as it was.
You see, there's something wrong with it.
What's wrong with it? Mrs. Boscawen stretched out a clay-smeared finger and jabbed at a spot just below the bridge spanning the canal.
There, she said. You see? There's a boat tied up under the bridge, isn't there?
Yes, said Tommy, puzzled.
Well, that boat wasn't there. Not when I last saw it. William never painted that boat. When it was exhibited, there was no boat of any kind.
Well, you mean that somebody, not your husband, painted the boat in here afterwards?
Yes. Odd, isn't it? I wonder why.
First of all, I was surprised to see the boat there, a place where there wasn't any boat. Then I can see quite well that it wasn't painted by William.
He didn't put it in at any time. Somebody else did. I wonder who.
She looked at Tommy.
And I wonder why.
Tommy had no solution to offer. He looked at Mrs. Boscawen. His Aunt Ada would have called her a scatty woman, but Tommy did not think of her in that light. She was vague, with an abrupt way of jumping from one subject to another. The things she said seemed to have very little relation to the last thing she had said a minute before. She was that sort of person. The sort of person, Tommy thought, who might know a great deal more than she chose to reveal. Had she loved her husband, or been jealous of her husband, or despised her husband? There was really no clue whatever in her manner, or indeed her words. But he had the feeling that that small painted boat tied up under the bridge had caused her uneasiness. She hadn't liked the boat being there. Suddenly he wondered if the statement she had made was true. Would she really remember from long years back whether Boscawen had painted the boat at the bridge or had not? It seemed really a very small and insignificant item, but it had made Mrs. Boscawen uneasy. He looked at her again and saw that she was looking at him, her curious eyes resting on him, not defiantly, but only thoughtfully. Very, very thoughtfully.
What are you going to do now? She said.
That at least was easy. Tommy had no difficulty in knowing what he was going to do now. I shall go home tonight, see if there is any news of my wife, any word from her. If not, tomorrow I shall go to this place, he said. Sutton Chancellor. I hope that I may find my wife there.
It would depend, said Mrs. Boscawen.
Depend on what? Said Tommy sharply. Mrs. Boscawen frowned. Then she murmured, seemingly to herself,
I wonder where she is.
You wonder where who is? Mrs. Boscawen had turned her glance away from him. Now her eyes swept back.
Oh, she said, I meant your wife.
Then she said, I hope she is all right. Why shouldn't she be all right? Tell me, Mrs. Boscawen, is there something wrong with that place? With Sutton Chancellor?
With Sutton Chancellor? With the place? She reflected. No, I don't think so. Not with the place.
Well, I suppose I meant the house, said Tommy. This house by the canal, not Sutton Chancellor Village.
Oh, the house, said Mrs. Boscawen. It was a good house, really. Meant for lovers, you know.
Did lovers live there?
Sometimes. Not often enough, really. If a house is built for lovers, it ought to be lived in by lovers.
Not put to some other use by someone?
You're pretty quick, said Mrs. Boscawen. You saw what I meant, didn't you? You mustn't put a house that was meant for one thing to the wrong use. It won't like it if you do.
Do you know anything about the people who have lived there of late years? She shook her head.
No. No, I don't know anything about the house at all. It was never important to me, you see.
But you're thinking of something, no? Someone?
Yes, said Mrs. Boscawen. I suppose you're right about that. I was thinking of someone.
Can't you tell me about the person you were thinking of?
There's really nothing to say, said Mrs. Boscawen. Sometimes, you know, one just wonders where a person is, what's happened to them, or how they might have developed. There's a sort of feeling.
She waved her hands.
Would you like a kipper?
She said unexpectedly. A kipper? Tommy was startled.
Well, I happen to have two or three kippers here. I thought perhaps you ought to have something to eat before you catch a train. Euston is the station, she said. For Sutton Chancellor, I mean. You used to have to change at Market Basing. I expect you still do.
It was a dismissal. He accepted it.
Chapter 13 Albert on Clues
Tuppence blinked her eyes. Vision seemed rather dim. She tried to lift her head from the pillow, but winced as a sharp pain ran through it and let it drop again onto the pillow. She closed her eyes. Presently she opened them again and blinked once more. With a feeling of achievement, she recognized her surroundings.
"I'm in a hospital ward," thought Tuppence.
Satisfied with her mental progress so far, she attempted no more brainy deduction. She was in a hospital ward, and her head ached. Why it ached, why she was in a hospital ward, she was not quite sure.
"Accident?" thought Tuppence.
There were nurses moving around beds. That seemed natural enough. She closed her eyes and tried a little cautious thought. A faint vision of an elderly figure in clerical dress passed across a mental screen.
"Father?" said Tuppence doubtfully. "Is it father?"
She couldn't really remember. She supposed so.
"But what am I doing ill in a hospital?" thought Tuppence. "I mean, I nurse in a hospital. So I ought to be in uniform. VAD uniform." "Oh dear," said Tuppence.
Presently a nurse materialized near her bed.
"Feeling better now, dear?"
said the nurse with a kind of false cheerfulness.
"That's nice, isn't it?"
Tuppence wasn't quite sure whether it was nice. The nurse said something about a nice cup of tea.
"I seem to be a patient,"
said Tuppence, rather disapprovingly to herself. She lay still, resurrecting in her own mind various detached thoughts and words.
"Soldiers,"
said Tuppence.
"VADs." "That's it, of course. I'm a VAD.
The nurse brought her some tea in a kind of feeding cup and supported her whilst she sipped it. The pain went through her head again.
"A VAD. That's what I am," said Tuppence aloud.
The nurse looked at her in an uncomprehending fashion.
"My head hurts," said Tuppence, adding a statement of fact. "It'll be better soon," said the nurse.
She removed the feeding cup, reporting to a sister as she passed along. "Number 14's awake. She's a bit wonky, though, I think."
"Did she say anything?"
"Said she was a VIP," said the nurse.
The ward sister gave a small snort, indicating that that was how she felt towards unimportant patients who reported themselves to be VIPs.
"We shall see about that," said the sister. "Hurry up, nurse, don't be all day with that feeding cup."
Tuppence remained half drowsy on her pillows. She had not yet got beyond the stage of allowing thoughts to flit through her mind in a rather disorganized procession.
There was somebody who ought to be here, she felt.
Somebody she knew quite well.
There was something very strange about this hospital.
It wasn't the hospital she remembered. It wasn't the one she had nursed in.
"All soldiers, that was," said Tuppence to herself. "The surgical ward. I was on A and B rows."
She opened her eyelids and took another look round. She'd decided it was a hospital she had never seen before, and that it had nothing to do with the nursing of surgical cases, military or otherwise.
"I wonder where this is," said Tuppence. "What place?"
She tried to think of the name of some place. The only places she could think of were London and Southampton. The ward sister now made her appearance at the bedside.
"Feeling a little better, I hope?" she said.
"I'm all right," said Tuppence. "What's the matter with me?"
"You hurt your head. I expect you find it rather painful, don't you?"
"It aches," said Tuppence. "Where am I?"
"Market Basing Royal Hospital."
Tuppence considered this information. It meant nothing to her at all.
"An old clergyman," she said.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Oh, nothing particular.
We haven't been able to write your name on your diet sheet yet," said the ward sister.
She held her biro pen at the ready and looked inquiringly at Tuppence.
"My name?"
"Yes," said the sister. "For the records," she added helpfully.
Tuppence was silent, considering. A name. What was her name?
"How silly," said Tuppence to herself. "I seem to have forgotten it. And yet I must have a name."
Suddenly a faint feeling of relief came to her. The elderly clergyman's face flashed suddenly across her mind, and she said with decision,
"Oh, of course, Prudence."
"Prudence?"
That's right, said Tuppence.
Well, that's your Christian name. The surname?
Cowley. C-O-W-L-E-Y.
Well, glad to get that straight, said the sister, and moved away again with an air of one whose records were no longer worrying her. Tuppence felt faintly pleased with herself.
Prudence Cowley. Prudence Cowley in the VAD, and her father was a clergyman at something vicarage. And it was wartime, and...
Funny, said Tuppence to herself. I seem to be getting all this wrong. It seems to me it all happened a long time ago,
she murmured to herself.
Was it your poor child?
She wondered.
Was it she who had just said that, or was it somebody else said it to her?
The sister was back again.
Your address, she said. Miss Cowley. Or is it Mrs. Cowley? Did you ask about a child?
Was it your poor child? Did somebody say that to me, or am I saying it to them?
I think I should sleep a little if I were you now, dear, said the sister.
She went away and took the information she had obtained to the proper place.
She seems to have come to herself, doctor, she remarked, and she says her name is Prudence Cowley, but she doesn't seem to remember her address. She said something about a child.
Oh, well, said the doctor, with his usual casual air. We'll give her another 24 hours or so. She's coming round from the concussion quite nicely. Tommy fumbled with his latchkey. Before he could use it, the door came open, and Albert stood in the open aperture.
Well, said Tommy, is she back?
Albert slowly shook his head.
No word from her, no telephone message, no letters waiting, no telegrams. Nothing, I tell you, sir, nothing whatever. And nothing from anyone else, either.
They're lying low, but they've got her. That's what I think. They've got her.
What the devil do you mean, they've got her? Said Tommy. The things you read. Who've got her?
Well, you know what I mean. The gang.
What gang?
One of those gangs with flick knives, maybe. Or an international one.
Stop talking rubbish, said Tommy.
Do you know what I think?
Albert looked inquiringly at him.
I think it's extremely inconsiderate of her not to send us word of some kind, said Tommy.
Oh, said Albert. Well, I see what you mean, I suppose. You could put it that way.
If it makes you happier, he added rather unfortunately.
He removed the parcel from Tommy's arms.
I see you brought that picture back, he said.
Yes, I've brought the bloody picture back, said Tommy. A fat lot of use it's been.
You haven't learnt anything from it?
Well, that's not quite true, said Tommy. I have learnt something from it. But whether what I've learnt is going to be of any use to me, I don't know. He added, Dr. Murray didn't ring up, I suppose, or Miss Packard from Sunny Ridge Nursing Home, nothing like that.
Well, nobody's rung up except the greengrocer to say he's got some nice aubergines.
He knows the missus is fond of aubergines. He always lets her know, but I told him she wasn't available just now. He added, I've got a chicken for your dinner.
It's extraordinary that you would never think of anything but chickens, said Tommy unkindly.
It's what they call a poussin this time, said Albert.
Skinny, he added.
It'll do, said Tommy.
The telephone rang. Tommy was out of his seat and had rushed to it in a moment.
Hello, hello?
A faint and faraway voice spoke.
Mr. Thomas Beresford, can you accept a personal call from Invergashley?
Yes.
Hold the line, please.
Tommy waited. His excitement was calming down. He had to wait some time. Then a voice he knew, crisp and capable, sounded, the voice of his daughter.
Hello, is that you, Pop?
Deborah.
Yes, why are you sounding so breathless? Have you been running?
Daughters, Tommy thought, were always critical.
I wheeze a bit at my age, he said. How are you, Deborah?
Oh, I'm all right. Look here, Dad, I saw something in the paper. Perhaps you've seen it too. I wondered about it.
Something about someone who had had an accident and was in hospital.
Well, I don't think I saw anything of that kind. I mean, not to notice it in any way. Why?
Well, it didn't sound too bad. I suppose it was a car accident or something like that. It mentioned that the woman, whoever it was, an elderly woman, gave her name as Prudence Cowley, but they were unable to find her address.
Prudence Cowley?
You mean? Well, yes, I only wondered.
That is Mother's name, isn't it? I mean, it was her name.
Well, of course. I always forget about the Prudence. I mean, we've never thought of her as Prudence, you or I or Derek either.
No, said Tommy. No, it's not the kind of Christian name one would associate much with your mother.
No, I know it isn't. I just thought it was rather odd. You don't think it might be some relation of hers?
I suppose it might be. Where was this?
Hospital at Market Basing, I think it said. They wanted to know more about her, I gather. I just wondered. Well, I know it's awfully silly. There must be quantities of people called Cowley and quantities of people called Prudence. But I thought I'd just ring up and find out, make sure, I mean, that Mother was at home and all right and all that.
I see, said Tommy. Yes, I see.
Well, go on, Pop, is she at home?
No, said Tommy. She isn't at home, and I don't know either whether she is all right or not.
What do you mean? Said Deborah. What's Mother been doing? I suppose you've been up in London with that hush-hush, utterly secret, idiotic survival from past days joying with all the old boys.
Well, you're quite right, said Tommy. I got back from that yesterday evening.
And you found Mother away? Or did you know she was away? Come on, Pop, tell me about it. You're worried.
I know when you're worried well enough.
What's Mother been doing? She's been up to something, hasn't she? I wish at her age she'd learn to sit quietly and not do things.
Oh, she's been worried, said Tommy. Worried about something that happened in connection with your great-aunt Ada's death.
What sort of thing?
Well, something that one of the patients at the nursing home had said to her. She got worried about this old lady. She started talking a good deal, and your mother was worried about some of the things she said, and so when we went to look through Aunt Ada's things, we suggested talking to this old lady, and it seems that she'd left rather suddenly.
Well, that seems quite natural, doesn't it?
Some of her relatives came and fetched her away.
Well, it still seems quite natural, said Deborah.
Why did Mother get the wind up?
She got it into her head, said Tommy, that something might have happened to this old lady.
I see. Not to put too fine a point on it, as the saying goes, she seems to have disappeared. All in quite a natural way, I mean, vouched for by lawyers and banks and all that, only we haven't been able to find out where she is.
You mean Mother's gone off to look for her somewhere?
Yes, and she didn't come back when she said she was coming back 2 days ago.
And haven't you heard from her?
No.
I wish to goodness you could look after Mother properly, said Deborah severely.
None of us have ever been able to look after her properly, said Tommy.
Not you either, Deborah, if it comes to that.
It's the same way she went off in the war and did a lot of things that she'd no business to be doing.
But it's different now. I mean, she's quite old. She ought to sit at home and take care of herself.
I suppose she's been getting bored. That's at the bottom of it all.
Market Basing Hospital, did you say? Said Tommy.
Melfordshire. About 2 hours from London, I think, by train.
That's it, said Tommy. And there's a village near Market Basing called Sutton Chancellor.
What's that got to do with it? Said Deborah.
Oh, it's too long to go into now, said Tommy. It has to do with a picture painted of a house near a bridge by a canal.
I don't think I can hear you very well, said Deborah. What are you talking about?
Never mind, said Tommy. I'm going to ring up Market Basing Hospital and find out a few things. I've a feeling that it's your mother, all right. People, if they've had concussion, you know, often remember things first that happened when they were a child and only get slowly to the present. She's gone back to her maiden name. She may have been in a car accident, but I shouldn't be surprised if somebody hadn't given her a conk on the head. It's the sort of thing that happens to your mother. She gets into things. I'll let you know what I find out.
40 minutes later, Tommy Beresford glanced at his wristwatch and breathed a sigh of utter weariness as he replaced the receiver with a final clang on the telephone rest. Albert made an appearance.
What about your dinner, sir? He demanded. You haven't eaten a thing.
And I'm sorry to say I forgot about that chicken. Burnt to a cinder.
I don't want anything to eat, said Tommy. What I want is a drink. Bring me a double whiskey.
Coming, sir, said Albert.
A few moments later, he brought the required refreshment to where Tommy had slumped down in the worn but comfortable chair reserved for his special use.
And now, I suppose, said Tommy, you want to hear everything.
Matter of fact, sir, said Albert with a slightly apologetic tone, I know most of it. You see, seeing as it was a question of the missus and all that, I took the liberty of lifting up the extension in the bedroom. I didn't think you'd mind, sir, not as it was the missus.
I don't blame you, said Tommy. Actually, I'm grateful to you.
If I had to start explaining... Got on to everyone, didn't you? The hospital and the doctor and the matron? Oh, no need to go over it all again, said Tommy. Market Basing Hospital, said Albert. Never breathed a word of that, she didn't. Never left it behind as an address or anything like that. Well, she didn't intend it to be her address, said Tommy. As far as I can make out, she was probably coshed on the head in an out-of-the-way spot somewhere. Someone took her along in a car and dumped her at the side of the road somewhere to be picked up as an ordinary hit-and-run. He added, Call me at 6:30 tomorrow morning. I want to get an early start. I'm sorry about your chicken getting burnt up again in the oven. I only put it on to keep it warm and forgot about it. Oh, never mind chickens, said Tommy. I've always thought they were very silly birds, running under cars and clucking about. Bury the corpse tomorrow morning, and give it a good funeral. She's not at death's door or anything, is she, sir? Asked Albert. Subdue your melodramatic fancies, said Tommy. If you'd done any proper listening, you'd have heard that she's come nicely to herself again, knows who she is, or was, and where she is, and they've sworn to keep her there waiting for me until I arrive to take charge of it again. On no account is she to be allowed to slip out by herself and go off again doing some more tomfool detective work. Talking of detective work, said Albert, and hesitated with a slight cough. I don't particularly want to talk about it, said Tommy. Forget it, Albert. Teach yourself bookkeeping or window box gardening or something. Well, I was just thinking, I mean, as a matter of clues. Well, what about clues? Well, I've been thinking. That's where all the trouble in life comes from. Thinking. Clues, said Albert again. That picture, for instance. That's a clue, isn't it? Tommy observed that Albert had hung the picture of the house by the canal up on the wall. Well, if that picture's a clue to something, what do you think it's a clue to? He blushed slightly at the inelegancy of the phrase he had just coined. I mean, what's it all about? I mean, it ought to mean something. What I was thinking of, said Albert, if you'll excuse me mentioning it. Go ahead, Albert. What I was thinking of was that desk.
Desk?
Yeah, the one that came by the furniture removers, with the little table and the two chairs and the other things. Family property, it was, you said.
It belonged to my Aunt Ada, said Tommy.
Well, that's what I meant, sir. That's the sort of place where you find clues. In old desks, antiques.
Well, possibly, said Tommy.
It wasn't my business, I know, and I suppose I really oughtn't to have gone messing about with it, but while you were away, sir, I couldn't help it. I had to go and have a look.
What, a look into the desk?
Yeah, just to see if there might be a clue there. You see, desks like that, they have secret drawers.
Possibly, said Tommy.
Well, there you are. There might be a clue there, hidden, shut up in the secret drawer.
It's an agreeable idea, said Tommy. But there's no reason, as far as I know, for my Aunt Ada to hide things away in secret drawers.
Oh, you never know with old ladies. They like tucking things away. Like jackdaws they are, or magpies. I forget which it is. There might be a secret will in it, or something written in invisible ink, or a treasure. Where you'd find some hidden treasure.
I'm sorry, Albert, but I think I'm going to have to disappoint you. I'm pretty sure there's nothing of that kind in that nice old family desk which once belonged to my Uncle William. Another man who turned crusty in his old age, besides being stone deaf and having a very bad temper.
What I thought is, said Albert, it wouldn't do any harm to look, would it?
He added virtuously, it needed cleaning out anyway. You know how old things are with old ladies. They don't turn them out much, not when they're rheumatic and find it hard to get about.
Tommy paused for a moment or two. He remembered that Tuppence and he had looked quickly through the drawers of the desk, had put their contents, such as they were, in two large envelopes, and removed a few skeins of wool, two cardigans, a black velvet stole, and three fine pillowcases from the lower drawers, which they had placed, with other clothing and odds and ends, for disposal. They had also looked through such papers as there had been in the envelopes, after their return home with them. There had been nothing there of particular interest.
We looked through the contents, Albert, he said. Spent a couple of evenings, really. One or two quite interesting old letters, some recipes for boiling ham, some other recipes for preserving fruit, some ration books and coupons and things dating back to the war. There was nothing of any interest.
Oh, that, said Albert. But that's just papers and things, as you might say, just ordinary go and come where everybody gets holed up in desks and drawers and things. I mean real secret stuff. When I was a boy, you know, I did 6 months with an antique dealer, helping him fake up things as often as not.
but I got to know about secret drawers that way. They usually run to the same pattern, three or four well-known kinds, and they vary it now and then. Don't you think, sir, you ought to have a look? I mean, I didn't like to go it myself, with you not here. It would have been presuming. He looked at Tommy with the air of a pleading dog. Come on, Albert, said Tommy, giving in. Let's go and presume. A very nice piece of furniture, thought Tommy, as he stood by Albert's side, surveying this specimen of his inheritance from Aunt Ada. Nicely kept. Beautiful old polish on it, showing the good workmanship and craftsmanship of days gone by. Well, Albert, he said, go ahead. This is your bit of fun, but don't go and strain it. Oh, I was ever so careful. I didn't crack it or slip knives into it or anything like that. First of all, we let down the front and put it on these two slab things that pull out. That's right, you see. The flap comes down this way, and that's where the old lady used to sit. Nice little mother-of-pearl blotting case your Aunt Ada had. It was in the left-hand drawer. There are these two things, said Tommy. He drew out two delicate, pilastered, shallow, vertical drawers. Oh, them, sir, you can push papers in them, but there's nothing really secret about them. The most usual place is to open the little middle cupboard, and then at the bottom of it, usually, there's a little depression, and you slide the bottom out, and there's a space. But there's always other ways and places. This desk is the kind that has a kind of well underneath. Well, that's not very secret either, is it? You just slide back a panel. The point is, it looks as though you've found all there was to find. You push back the panel, and there's the cavity, and you can put a good many things in there that you want to keep a bit from being poured over and all that. But that's not all, as you might say, because you see, here, there's a little piece of wood in front, like a little ledge. You can pull that up, you see? Yes, said Tommy. Yes, I can see. You pull that up, and you've got a secret cavity there, just beyond the middle lock. But there's nothing in it. No, said Albert. It looks disappointing. But if you slip your hand into that cavity and you wiggle it along, either to the left or the right, there are two little thin drawers, one each side. There's a little semicircle cut out of the top, and you can hook your finger over that and pull it gently towards you. During these remarks, Albert seemed to be getting his wrist in what was almost a contortionist position. Sometimes they stick a little. Wait, wait, here she comes. Albert's hooked forefinger drew something towards him from the inside. He clawed it gently forward until the narrow, small drawer showed in the opening. He hooked it out and laid it before Tommy, with the air of a dog bringing his bone to his master. Now, wait a minute, sir. There's something in here, something wrapped up in a long, thin envelope. Now we'll do the other side. He changed hands and resumed his contortionist clawings. Presently, a second drawer was brought to light and was laid beside the first one. But there's something in here, too, said Albert. Another sealed-up envelope that someone's hidden here one time or another. I've not tried to open either of them. I wouldn't do such a thing. His voice was virtuous in the extreme. I left that to you. But what I say is, they may be clues. Together, he and Tommy extracted the contents of the dusty drawers. Tommy took out first a sealed envelope rolled up lengthways with an elastic band round it. The elastic band parted as soon as it was touched. Looks valuable, said Albert. Tommy glanced at the envelope. It bore the superscription, confidential. There you are, said Albert. Confidential! It's a clue! Tommy extracted the contents of the envelope. In a faded handwriting, and very scratchy handwriting at that, there was a half-sheet of notepaper. Tommy turned it this way and that, and Albert leaned over his shoulder, breathing heavily. Mrs. MacDonald's recipe for salmon cream, Tommy read. Given to me as a special favour. Take 2 pounds of middle cut of salmon, 1 pint of Jersey cream, a wine glass of brandy, and a fresh cucumber. He broke off. I'm sorry, Albert. It's a clue which will lead us to good cookery, no doubt. Albert uttered sounds indicative of disgust and disappointment. Never mind, said Tommy. Here's another one to try. The next sealed envelope did not appear to be one of quite such antiquity. It had two pale grey wax seals affixed to it, each bearing a representation of a wild rose. Pretty, said Tommy. Rather fanciful for Aunt Ada. How to cook a beefsteak pie, I expect.
Tommy ripped open the envelope. He raised his eyebrows. 10 carefully folded £5 notes fell out. Nice thin ones, said Tommy. They're the old ones. You know, the kind we used to have in the war. Decent paper. Probably aren't legal tender nowadays.
Money, said Albert. What's she want with all that money?
Oh, that's an old lady's nest egg, said Tommy. Aunt Ada always had a nest egg. Years ago, she told me that every woman should always have £50 in £5 notes with her in case of what she called emergencies.
Well, I suppose it'll still come in handy, said Albert.
I don't suppose they're absolutely obsolete. I think you can make some arrangement to change them at a bank.
There's another one still, said Albert. The one from the other drawer.
The next was bulkier. There seemed to be more inside it, and it had 3 large, important-looking red seals. On the outside was written in the same spiky hand, "In the event of my death, this envelope should be sent unopened to my solicitor, Mr. Rockbury, of Rockbury and Tompkins, or to my nephew, Thomas Beresford, not to be opened by any unauthorized person." There were several sheets of closely written paper. The handwriting was bad, very spiky, and here and there somewhat illegible. Tommy read it aloud with some difficulty. "I, Ada Maria Fanshawe, am writing down here certain matters which have come to my knowledge and which have been told me by people who are residing in this nursing home called Sunny Ridge. I cannot vouch for any of this information being correct, but there seems to be some reason to believe that suspicious, possibly criminal activities are taking place here, or have taken place here. Elizabeth Moody, a foolish woman, but not, I think, untruthful, declares that she has recognized here a well-known criminal. There may be a poisoner at work among us. I myself prefer to keep an open mind, but I shall remain watchful. I propose to write down here any facts that come to my knowledge. The whole thing may be a mare's nest. Either my solicitor or my nephew, Thomas Beresford, is asked to make full investigation."
"There," said Albert triumphantly. "Told you so. It's a clue."